I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest has been asked this question. He says, over and over, do I really need to sleep? Exactly what spending a third of our lives unconscious gets us has long mystified scientists. He's written in a piece in Scientific American, Beyond Memory, The Benefits of Sleep. One of the world's foremost sleep researchers said in 1978, if sleep doesn't serve an absolutely vital function, then it's the biggest mistake the evolutionary process has ever made. Well, it turns out that research, particularly over the last 20 years, shows that sleep plays many vital functions. Dr. Robert Stickgold is our guest. He's director of the Center for Sleep and Cognition at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. And he looks at the research over the past 20 years, which has finally, he says, begun to provide at least a partial explanation for why we sleep. And it's not a single purpose. So we're going to learn about that this hour because we're all wide awake at this moment. If you feel like you have to take a nap, that's all right. You can listen to us online at another time. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter is at K Dunn Show, and Dr. Robert Stickgold, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure to join you.
I like to sleep, but, you know, at times when you think about one-third, and when I said that out loud, one-third of our lives sleeping, it's such a big chunk of our lives, isn't it?
Well, it's a big chunk, but I think what we can see with humans is that evolution over time has discovered that that's the amount of time we need to basically disconnect from the outside world and take care of ourselves inside.
Right. Can you die if you don't get enough sleep?
Well, the answer is yes, but the more reassuring answer is that you can't not get enough sleep unless you have very specific and very uncommon medical disorders. If you try not to sleep, you can get along for maybe a couple of days. When scientists try to get people out to 3 days without sleep, it basically involves two people shouting at the person all day and making them walk around continuously. We really cannot, after some point, fight the urge to sleep. So whereas people who have a condition known as fatal familial insomnia do, in fact, stop sleeping altogether, and as the name implies, they do die from it, the rest of us aren't really at risk for that.
Mm-hmm. But you do say in your article that we do know that as little as one night of complete or even partial sleep loss can interfere with various bodily functions.
Absolutely. So there's a big difference between a loss of sleep that's sufficient to cause death and a loss of sleep that's sufficient to cause a significant and an important deterioration in your body and your health. Let me give you an example.
Sure.
There was a study, there have been two studies, one done in Chicago, one done in Germany, where in the German case, they gave people a hepatitis vaccination, and then half the subjects, they kept awake the next night. So instead of going to bed at their normal bedtime, they were kept awake an extra 24 hours, only allowed to go to bed the following night. And then they looked at those two groups over the next 4 weeks, as their body, responding to the vaccination, began to make and produce antibodies against the hepatitis. And what they find is that at 4 weeks, which is sort of when that response in your body peaks, those who missed a single night of sleep after the vaccination had 49% less antibodies.
Goodness gracious.
And a huge deficit. And you can think of it in terms of vaccination, but you can also think of it as exposure to any disease. You get exposed to the flu, you get exposed to any disease, and your body normally makes antibodies to fight that disease. And if you lose sleep afterwards, it can have a huge and profound deleterious effect to the point that your body is not mounting a sufficient antibody response to effectively fight the disease. Hmm. One night of sleep.
Interesting. So that advice about taking aspirin and get plenty of rest, you should have gotten plenty of rest, and then maybe you wouldn't have needed the aspirin, right?
There you go.
This other thing, and I found this to be true, when I don't get very much sleep, I find myself having to eat a lot during the next day just to stay alert. This is very interesting studies that shows that if you don't get enough sleep, you can get fat.
Yes, yes. We don't have exactly that data, since it would probably be unethical to keep people awake enough until they get fat. But we do know that if you take college students, for example, and just restrict their sleep to half of normal, to 4 hours of sleep a night for 5 days, and then you check how their insulin function is working, it's looking horrible. They're starting to look like people with type 2 diabetes. And that means that they can't clear glucose from their blood at the normal rate. And that, in turn, leads to fat deposition. So what we're seeing is that it might be that some of this epidemic of obesity that everybody is talking about so much might really be an epidemic in sleep loss.
Hmm. Well, that's a very important connection to make, isn't it?
It is. And it's not just obesity, but it's type 2 diabetes. If you look at people with type 2 diabetes and look at the relationship between how severe their symptoms are and how much sleep they're getting, the less sleep they get, the worse their symptoms are.
The other fascinating part of what you write is the greatest impact being in the brain. A single night of sleep deprivation can affect the emotional memories that you lay down.
Yeah, a lot of these, when I look at them sort of impartially, are scary. So Matt Walker, who was a student of mine, is now a professor out at Berkeley, did this wonderful study where he brought college students in, and he had them just look at lists of words on the computer screen and say, is this a positive emotional word that's making you feel good? Is it a negative word? Is it a neutral word? He just had them looking at them as they went by on the screen and rating them as positive, negative, or neutral. And then 3 days later, he brought them back and gave them a surprise test to see whether they remembered which words they had seen and which words they hadn't. And what he did is he had two groups of students, and one of the groups he kept up the night before they were shown the words. So when they were doing this, looking at the words and rating them as positive or negative, they were in a sleep-deprived state. What he found then, 3 days later, after they had had lots of time to get their normal sleep back, when he looked at what they remembered, the ones who were sleep-deprived, by and large, were only remembering the negative words they saw.
Ooh.
In fact, if you looked at the control subjects who were sleeping normally, they remembered equal numbers of positive and negative words. But the sleep-deprived group remembered twice as many negative words as positive words.
So
they have this completely biased view of what happened to them 3 days ago. They see their memory of the past is much more negative than it actually should have been. And sometimes when I'm in a crabby mode, I say, this is what caused the first Gulf War. That the first Gulf War came about because all the decision makers were getting information about, there's weapons of mass destruction, bad. Oh, no, they're probably not weapons of mass destruction, good. No, they are weapons of mass destruction. No, they're not. And they were all incredibly sleep-deprived.
Right.
And so when they come to a decision point, what they remember is all the negative things they were told, and only half as many of the positive.
So the ramifications of this are huge on many levels.
Whether it's politicians or military leaders or just corporate leaders who at some critical point in their company's lifespan have a crucial decision that has to be made, leading them to stay up late or even stay up all night to try to master what they should be doing, they're going to make the wrong decision.
Mm. But if you get a good night's rest in the days subsequent, do you change your mind?
No, because the memories aren't there.
Oh.
Because that's exactly how Matt looked at it. Sleep deprivation for one night, then hear all the information, then sleep normally for 3 nights, and then take the test. Hmm. And that's when they don't remember it.
Mm. A number of people, actually, I know, and it seems to be more and more people are getting these machines because they suffer from sleep apnea.
Yeah.
And you talk about in the article this link between, and it's fairly substantial, between sleep apnea and major depression.
Yes. So it's one of those things that it's funny. We sort of ran across it by chance when a colleague of mine was doing a study of depressed patients and started to hear from more and more of them that, well, they were also getting really bad sleep. And so she said, well, okay, I don't want to study those. I want to study people who are just depressed and didn't have sleep apnea. Sleep apnea, for those who don't know in your audience, is a medical disorder where because usually of excess fat in the neck, people with very large necks, when you're sleeping, the airways tend to collapse, and so they snore and they snort and they stop breathing, and then they have to wake up in order to start breathing again. And if you have severe apnea, you could do that every minute all night long.
Every minute?
Every minute all night long,
Ooh. And
that average of 60 times an hour. The definition of severe apnea is more than 30, so that's more than once every 2 minutes. So they can people do this all night long. And so she looked for people without apnea, and she had a dickens of a time trying to find any. And she came to talk to me, and I said, I've never heard of that. And we talked to some sleep people, and they were very funny. They said, oh, those people with apnea, they're not actually depressed. That's just their sleep apnea. People with sleep apnea look depressed. And I say, well, what do you mean? I say, well, you know, they've got low interest, you know, they're unhappy all the time, they have negative views of their lives, they can't motivate themselves. And I say, that's the definition of depression. And they say, it's not real depression, though. It's just, so to them, it's such a common thing in apnea that they think of it as just part of apnea. So it turns out that if you have apnea, you're 4 times more likely to be depressed than the regular population. And in fact, if you're depressed, you're 5 times more likely to have sleep apnea.
Hmm.
So if you're not getting enough sleep, if your sleep is being disrupted too much, you have a very, very high probability of becoming depressed. And all you have to do is have a friend who stays up one night and just watch them the next day. And they get cranky, and they get sort of dysfunctional, and they get depressed. You can sort of almost see it after a single night.
Right. And those machines really reduce the symptoms of depression, those CPAC machines?
Yes. When they've done studies where they find people who are both have depression and sleep apnea, if they treat the sleep apnea, and what these machines do is you just wear a mask sort of over your nose and mouth, and it blows a little bit of air in to sort of keep those airways expanded so that they don't collapse. So it's not a drug, and it's not an injection or anything. It's not electrical stimulation. It's just mechanically keeping those passages open. When they take these people who are both depressed and have sleep apnea and put them on these machines and bring them back a couple months later, in large part, on average, the depression is gone.
Hmm.
And just as a side comment, with kids, what you see with sleep apnea is not depression, but ADHD. And there have been some studies with kids where, with kids, it's not the airways collapsing. It's usually like enlarged tonsils or adenoids. And so the way they'll treat the sleep apnea is by taking out the tonsils or adenoids. And when they do that, they get a larger reduction in the ADHD symptoms than if they put the kids on the standard ADHD medications.
They don't do very much of that anymore, do they?
Which, the removing tonsils?
Yeah.
Not for the normal. So they used to remove tonsils if they just got enlarged by an infection. And that they don't do anymore. But these are kids who have chronic enlarged tonsils that are leading to enough obstruction of their airwaves that their breathing gets disrupted while they sleep.
I see. Our guest this hour, is Dr. Robert Stickgold. He's director of the Center for Sleep and Cognition at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's an associate professor at Harvard University, and he wrote a fascinating piece. Well, you're hearing what it's about. It's fascinating to listen to him, too. In Scientific American, Beyond Memory, The Benefits of Sleep. New evidence shows how sleep balances hormones and boosts immunity, among other things. We're going to welcome phone calls. We have several people who have called in already. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for Dr. Robert Stickgold. Why do we sleep? Why do we really need to sleep? The question of the hour, and he has the answers. Donna in Hartford is our first caller for you, Doctor. Hi, Donna.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you so much for this wonderful program. Two questions, one I thought of while listening to you this afternoon, Doctor. The first one, most importantly to me, is we're discussing lack of sleep. What, if you can tell us, are some of the negatives to getting too much sleep? I have a very close relative who can sleep in excess of 18 hours a day due to depression. Uh-huh. And this goes on for multiple days, on end. And then the second question would be, does it matter for all those people that are working second and third shift what time of day you're getting your sleep?
Those are two spectacular questions. Thank you for asking. The first one I was ready to give an answer to, and then you told me how much your relative sleeps, and I was taken aback. So I would be surprised if this person actually sleeps 18 hours a day. I would not be surprised with a severely depressed person that they spend 18 hours a day in bed. I don't know of any studies that find people actually sleep that much. So if we assume that, in fact, let's say the relative is actually sleeping 12 hours a night, which is certainly lots, lots more than we think almost anybody needs, what does that mean? And there's a real divided opinion on this. There are some people who think, well, it's part of the pathology of depression. Probably one imagines an attempt to avoid the real world. And then the downside is just that you're doing exactly that you're, that you're avoiding interacting in a world that could help you deal with the depression. The other view, and it's the one that I tend to lean towards, but again, it's without data because we don't really know how to ask the question scientifically. My leaning is that they're getting this extra sleep because their brain is calculating that they need it. That normally when we sleep, we process lots of our information that we take in the day before, lots of the memories we form, including a lot of the emotional memories we form. And it might be that these people are just highly ineffective at processing emotional memories while they're sleeping. That's part of the reason they're depressed, and the brain is trying to make up for this by giving them extra time. It's like extra time after class to do your homework if you don't get it done during school. And so the extra sleep is an attempt to make up for a reduced efficiency of sleep. But we really are in a tough place where we have no idea which of those two explanations is really correct.
Because it seems like for her, it's that's always been, if you will, her drug of choice. She is on medication for depression, but anytime anything goes wrong or whatever, zoop right back to bed. And are you saying you don't? I know for sure because she lives under my roof, so okay. I know how many hours a day she's in her bed. And okay. She can be snoring at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, get up for a couple of hours, do something, go back to bed, and be snoring at 5 o'clock again. So, I mean, it's consistent throughout the day and the night. It doesn't even matter what hours of day or night, this person can just sleep endlessly. I frankly couldn't get out of bed. My body would hurt so bad.
Yeah.
Yep.
I would think it would be fascinating to get her into a sleep lab and see how much of that time she's actually sleeping. Because I think I think if she's sleeping 18 hours in a day, she might be a world record holder on that.
Well,
and it might be fun to try to find out.
And second shift?
Yes, second shift. That one's easier. I'll tell you a funny story. When I was in college, before I was interested in sleep at all, I had a job working in the lab during the summer back home in outside of Chicago, as a matter of fact. And I think to avoid my parents, I tended to work nights rather than days so I could sleep during the day and avoid them.
Mm-hmm.
But my father made this comment to me. He said, you can't get a good night's sleep during the day. And it turns out that's true.
Hmm.
That people who are on either shift workers, and it's worse for them, who are, you know, every week or every 3 days are shifting from one shift to another, but also people who just have jobs where they are permanently on a night shift, we find that their sleep is never of the quality that you get. So they're sleeping during the daytime, and they never manage to get as good of sleep as they do if or other people do sleeping during the night. We have a whole system of circadian rhythms that has evolved way, way back before humans. We even see some of it in the blue-green algae, that we have evolved to live on this planet in a 24-hour daylight, day-night cycle. And our bodies are tuned to sleep efficiently at night and not during the day. So those people who are on night shifts will tell you that they don't sleep as well.
Thank you so much, Donna, for your call. And let's go to Josh in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to comment on my personal experience with sleep apnea and the effectiveness of those CPAP machines, as well as with weight loss in helping to correct that problem. Back in around 2004, I weighed around 400 pounds and had a sleep study, and I was stopping breathing 1 to 2 times a minute.
Mm.
So it was pretty significant. The first time I tried a CPAP machine, I got the best night's sleep that I could remember. And a year later, in 2005, I had a gastric bypass surgery and lost about 200 pounds from that and didn't need the machine anymore. The problem had corrected itself. So it really was, you know, kind of a remarkable turnaround for me with regards to dealing with that issue.
Yes, and can I ask you a question? When you said you had the best night's sleep ever, you're talking about the night or you're talking about how you felt in the morning?
How I felt in the morning. Prior to that, I was just constantly tired. I don't recall feeling depressed per se, but I was just always really fatigued, unmotivated because I was so tired, and just had a hard time really accomplishing things that I wanted to accomplish. I was just always tired. After I started using that machine, it was just night and day. I mean, I woke up refreshed, ready to go for the day, full of motivation and energy. It was remarkable.
Well, you are our poster child. We see that a lot. When the CPAP is set up properly and the pressure is right and it's keeping those airways open, people say things like, I forgot what it was like to be awake.
That's exactly how I felt. The one that I had just went over the nose. It had a heated humidifier on it. And it was a constant air pressure. So, you know, the air was always blowing in. It didn't shut off when I was breathing out like some of the machines do. But in the sleep lab, when I first tried it, I fell asleep almost instantly.
Right. So that's a great testimony. Thank you for that. And the other point is equally important, that this is often due to excessive weight. Clinicians, and I'm not a clinician, I just sort of hang with them. I'm really a basic science guy. But the clinicians all tell me, you know, someone walks into my office and I look at him and I say, sleep apnea, because of the weight issue. And really the ideal way to deal with sleep apnea is to deal with the weight issue. And then just as a side comment on that, to make it more difficult, Kathleen, as we were talking earlier, if you are having your sleep disrupted all the time and you are basically sleep deprived, that tends to make you want to eat more. So it sort of feeds that gain of weight that's making the apnea worse. But if you can, either through diet or gastric bypass, find some method of reducing the weight. That will very often solve the problem by itself.
Thanks, Josh, very much for your call. Those CPAC machines, I have friends who use those, and they seem large to me. Isn't there any going to be any technological improvement so they won't be as obtrusive?
Of course.
Oh, there will be, huh?
But I just have faith in American technology. But you've got two things that you have to have in the machine. You have to have a pump large enough to keep a significant airflow going into your mouth and nose to keep the airways open. And it also has to be able to humidify that air as it blows it in. Sometimes my father-in-law uses one, and he says that, you know, sometimes he's able to, like, move it quite far away and even get it into another room. But, yes, they tend to be large and bulky, and I can only suspect that as time goes on they're going to get smaller. But, mm-hmm. but there are some limitations just because of how much air they have to move, and they've got to be able to hold enough water to humidify that air all night long.
Mm. Let's talk about sleeping on a problem. Such a common phrase. Well, sleep on this. Not merely asking you, right, the sleeping brain to remember something. We want our brain to take the information that's already stored there and do some kind of calculation. The brain does that if we're sleeping well?
Yes, it does.
Oh.
And there have been a number of studies that have shown it. My favorite was a study done by a research group in Germany, where they taught subjects to how to do some simple math problems, an unusual kind of math problem where you have to process a series of digits on a screen and come up with a final answer. And it turns out that although they were teaching them one way to do it, there was a much simpler way to do it. And the question was, could they figure out that simpler way? And so in the actual training, only about 10% of the subjects figure it out. And they say, okay, thank you, goodbye, you're out of the study. But the other 90%, they would bring back 12 hours later and have them repeat it and see if now they figured out this shortcut. And half of the subjects were trained in the morning, went about their day, came back that evening for testing. And half of the subjects were trained in the evening, allowed to sleep all night, and were retested in the morning. And just to control, actually, for that day-night issue, they had a third group of subjects who were trained in the evening, kept awake all night, and tested in the morning. And what they found is that in the two groups that were kept awake for the 12 hours, either because it was just a regular daytime or because they kept them awake overnight, when they retested them, about 25% of the subjects discovered the shortcut over about an hour of doing this kind of problem over and over again. But in the group that had a chance to sleep on it, as we say, 62% figured out the shortcut. So you're 2.5 times more likely in that study to discover this shortcut, to gain this insight, to solve this problem, which in this case you didn't even know existed because you hadn't been told that there was an easier way to do it. But your brain, nonetheless, during the night, was searching, sort of saying, there must be an easier way to do this. And so they were 2.5 times more likely to find that shortcut. And we've done similar studies here where subjects actually get better at complicated tasks after a night of sleep, tasks where they don't really get what's going on, where they're sort of guessing at the answers and don't know what the rules are. After a night of sleep, they have a better sense, a better intuition as to how those rules are working in this particular study. So, yes, we say that you gain insight while you sleep. I've traveled a lot around the world, and everywhere I've gone, I've talked to people and say, so in your language, in English we say sleeping on a problem. Do you have a phrase like that? And everybody does.
Hmm.
And it's fun. In France, you take a problem to bed with you.
Hmm.
I thought that was very French. but no one, you know, nobody eats on a problem. Nobody drives
right.
on a problem.
Right.
Nobody watches TV on a problem.
Right.
They sleep on a problem. And I think what that reflects is the fact that we know individually and as a culture that it works. And what's interesting is that it works, it seems, most of the time, just based on discussions with people. There's some great examples of people who have in their sleep had dreams that have given them insights that, in at least three cases, led to Nobel Prizes in science. But those are rare events compared to our everyday sleeping on a problem. And I'll say that it's a really impressive calculation that the brain's doing. So the classic example that I give is you get an offer of a job that's the perfect job in the worst place you can imagine. And you're trying to decide, should I move there and take this new job, which, you know, moves me up the ladder, puts me in job for further promotions, is a real career boost, but I don't want to live there. And, you know, if you're sort of a compulsive person, you make one of those charts where you take a piece of the paper and you draw a line up and down and a line across, and you list the pluses and minuses of going and the pluses and minuses of staying. And that never seems to help anybody, really. But then you sleep on it, and next morning you just know the answer. You don't know where it came from. You don't know why you think that. But you've just got the answer. And I tell people, like, with that job question, it's a really complicated question. You're not thinking just about, well, do I want to live there, and, you know, how good a job is it really? But you're thinking about, does my spouse want to move there? How will my kids take the move? What will my parents think if I don't take the job? What will my friends think if I turn this down? It's a really complicated question where you can't really put numbers on it. You just have to wait for some sort of gut instinct to tell you what to do. And that tends to happen while we're asleep.
Hmm. Let's go to David next in South Milwaukee.
Good program again, Kathleen. Thank you. Doctor, I'm wondering if you're familiar with polyphasic sleeping, in which one can draw back their sleep by hour and a half segments and make up for it by every 4 hours taking a 20-minute nap, or if there is a form of napping which can make up for a sleep deficit. And then one other question I thought of while I was on the line is, are there long-term consequences to working third shift and getting poor sleep?
Two good questions. Let me just make sure I write them down. Okay, so the polyphasic sleep has no good data in support of. I'm not even sure exactly where the idea came from. I'd love to. I should go back and find out where it started. But this idea of sleeping sort of in four-hour cycles instead of 24-hour cycles, and that you can, by doing that, get away with less sleep than you need overnight, over consolidated sleep out at night. There's absolutely no scientific evidence to support that. Having said that, naps can serve the function of nocturnal sleep. You can nap either to make up for sleep or in some cases to prepare yourself for less sleep the following night. But there's no evidence that just in terms of how much a person appears to need, Naps seem to be sort of one-for-one trades for nighttime sleep.
And do you have to go into a REM cycle during those naps?
I don't think there's that much data, but those studies would have been long enough that people would have been going into it. 20-minute naps probably certainly would not get you into REM sleep unless you're seriously deprived of REM sleep. So if you were only sleeping 20-minute bouts every hour, say, or every 2 hours, you would eventually start getting REM sleep in them, but not in a normal 20-minute nap.
David, thank you. I'm sorry.
He had a second question. Long-term effects. Mm-hmm. And what we can tell you about that is that there have been studies with flight attendants who fly transatlantic or Far East routes who are constantly having their shifts changed. They fly to Tokyo and then they fly back. And so they're constantly on these shifting schedules, and compare them to other flight attendants. And there does appear to be an increased risk of cancer.
Really?
In those, yeah. And again, it might have to be, it probably has to do with immune function on some level, but that has not been sort of sorted out yet. But there is a significant increase in those cancer rates.
David, thank you so much for your call. We go next to Joy in West Bend. Hi.
Hi. I want to thank you for studying such an important topic. I have a story and a question. My story is about I have a friend who was a breastfeeding mother, and she told me the story that she was having trouble with her memory issues. She went to her regular doctor, and the doctor said she should have a scan of her brain. And she was going to have to stop breastfeeding while she had the scan. I don't know if it was because it was dangerous to the baby or if it was she was going to take medication or something. And then she, as soon as she stopped breastfeeding, she got her memory back, and, you know, it was really due to sleep deprivation. And then my question is, myself, I have a symptom of having trouble sleeping when I have eaten something with dairy in it, and, you know, I think of that as a dairy sensitivity. It makes me have monkey mind. I just can't stop thinking. I might feel really exhausted and not be able to get to sleep or not, or go to sleep and then wake up again. So I've never read that in any books, that it's a sign of a dairy sensitivity, but it certainly seems to happen for me.
Well, let me take those one at a time. The first case you gave of the breastfeeding mom, I mean, this is what we refer to as mommy brain. There is nothing more disruptive to one's sleep than a newborn who wakes you on their own schedule and not on yours.
Right.
It can have to do with breastfeeding. It can happen even if you're bottle feeding, because you're still getting up and still spending that time if you can't tell your husband to do it, for God's sake, half the time. But there's no question that both the reduction, that the loss of sleep and the disruption of sleep that you have in a situation like that does two things. It makes it harder to encode memories, to learn new things. But we also know that there's a vast amount of memory processing that goes on while we sleep, where we improve these memories from the day before, and we stabilize memories from the day before, and we identify what from the day before was really important to be sure to strengthen, to make sure that it's remembered. And when your sleep is disrupted, all of those normal functions of sleep go awry. They get terribly reduced. I mean, Kathleen, you asked at the start about spending so much time sleeping. I think what evolution has told us is that for every 2 hours we spend awake taking in new information, we need an hour of sleep to figure out whether to keep it, how to keep it, literally where in our brain to keep it. And if we don't get that chance, then we lose the benefit of having learned that stuff the day before.
Oh, that's fascinating. And how much can we keep? I mean, if you have a day where you're just filled with, if you're teaching or you're taking in new information, you're reading a whole lot, does our brain, can it store a whole lot of that information or just a portion of it?
Well, we certainly don't store it all. The amount of information we initially encode in a day is sort of beyond comprehension. But if you think about walking down the hall from your office to the bathroom and then to the cafeteria, you know, you pass 10 people and you don't want to remember who they were, right? And then you get to the cafeteria and you look around the cafeteria and there's all these faces you don't recognize. You don't want to remember them all. So most of what we probably initially encode, we don't even want to keep. But it's been, you know, I've told people I want to quantify how much you actually do encode in a day, and I don't think we really have good measures. But you can actually learn amazing amounts in a single day. I mean, you can read a book,
sure,
and then be able to go on for an hour describing the details of what you read. You can watch a movie. Some people can watch a movie and basically spit back the entire movie to you. So we can take in incredible amounts, and I think the brain is able to consolidate, to stabilize, to hold on across the night of sleep as much of that as it deems worth holding. And I don't know what that limit is, but I think it's quite high.
Huh.
Now, her second question, are you still there, Joy?
Yeah.
The Derry police haven't come after you? I mean, you're in Wisconsin.
Not yet.
You're not allowed to say things like that about Derry. But I have to tell you, I've never heard this one before.
Uh-huh.
So I don't have a lot to say, but you tell me that your mind is racing.
Right. I just have a lot of thoughts and can't turn them off.
Yeah.
And I can be physically exhausted. I can just, you know, I can even go to bed and go to sleep for an hour or two and then wake up and start thinking again, worrying, and I just can't sleep. And it's different if I don't eat something with dairy in it for a day or several days, then I sleep better.
Well, my guess, just hearing you describe it, is that it's not that the dairy is directly sort of interfering with your sleep, but that somehow it's cranking your mind up. And of course, the biggest cause of insomnia overall in the nation is this inability to let go of thinking. You know, when people say, "I've got insomnia, what can I do about it?" I say, "Oh, just stop worrying." And they look at me and say, "Thanks a lot," right? But it's almost that simple. So somehow you have to find a way, if you want to keep eating dairy, of quieting your mind. And there's actually cognitive behavioral therapies for insomnia now that help you learn ways to quiet your mind down, sort of various forms of meditation,
mm-hmm.
basically,
mm-hmm.
Which may or may not work for you. But I've never heard this one before, so thank you.
Yeah. I'm wondering if anybody, the mention of new moms and the fact that they just don't sleep, and you don't sleep for days. It's everybody I've talked to who's gone through this says you can't believe how completely exhausted you are for a long, long period of time. It's a wonder that new moms can function at all, because talk about sleep deprivation, and it's more than four nights.
Absolutely. And in fact, there have been, we did one small study, and others have done more studies subsequently, that show that people who have postpartum, women that have postpartum depression, that a large part of that might in fact be due to the sleep loss. And it's really interesting because sort of culturally with obstetricians, if you are a gynecologist, if you go to your obstetrician and say, you know, I've got a new baby and I just can't sleep, unless not getting sleep, they sort of laugh and say, well, that's what you signed up for. But if you go in and say, I'm really depressed, they say, oh, well, we have to treat that.
Yes.
There's somehow some way that insomnia and inadequate sleep is supposed to be something that you can just, you know, you can sort of suck it up and, you know, get over it. And it's not always at all possible. So there's no real solution for these moms except to get help. You know, to get either have the ability to sleep a lot during the day, which isn't necessarily an option either, or to get help from spouse or other family to give them some breaks and give them a chance to sleep more. It's crushing. I mean, I talk to women who insist that they don't know that their full mind ever came back, and that might be, you know, an exaggeration, but it's a profound disability that comes with that sleep loss.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is fascinating, Dr. Robert Stickgold, director of the Center for Sleep and Cognition at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's an associate professor at Harvard Medical School, and he came to our attention. We all sleep, or we try to sleep, so we thought this would be an interesting hour. He wrote a piece for Scientific American, Beyond Memory, The Benefits of Sleep, and they are substantial. We have to sleep. For a whole host of reasons. Here's our number, and we'll go back to phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here we have several emails that have come in. This from a listener. My son is 20 years old. As an infant, he had night terrors. As a fourth grader, he was afraid of falling asleep. Now he deals with anxiety, and the anxiety is disabling. What suggestions would you have for him, doctor?
This is where I make my disclaimer that my degree is in biochemistry and I'm not a clinician. So I'm giving advice without clinical training, and perhaps it's a bit inappropriate, but I'll take a shot at it.
Okay.
So the first statement was about night terrors. And night terrors are things that are usually seen in young kids. They occur during the deepest sleep, early in the night. And the child just seems to experience pure terror or fear. When they can be awoken, there doesn't seem to be a dream associated with it. It seems to be just, that's why it's a night terror as opposed to a nightmare, which is a bad dream. And the night terrors tend to disappear as the kids get just a little bit older. They don't seem to have any pernicious cause. They don't seem to predict anything going forward. So in general, if your child has night terrors, it's worse on you than the child, and they just outgrow them. Whether this particular case, the child was continuing to have night terrors, is unclear to me, because children usually are not at all aware of the fact that they're having them. My son had them.
Hmm.
And in the morning, we would say, so how did you sleep last night? And he'd just look and say, fine. Hmm. We'd say, you have anything scary during the night? He'd say, no. But he did.
Mm-hmm.
So why this child went on to develop a fear of sleep is unclear to me. And if this person ended up with anxiety, my suspicion is that that's independent. But I just don't, obviously have enough information to know. I would suggest talking to a PCP first, and then maybe getting a sleep study, or talking to a therapist or a psychiatrist.
Yes. Bernie is next in Muscadet. Hello.
Hi. Extremely fascinating show. I'm a normal guy, I think, in my mid-60s, and for the past 5 years, I have been sleeping for 4 hours, been awake for 4 hours, and then go back to sleep for 4 hours, and it's starting to be just totally normal for me to do this. I have read that in the past, this is actually the way people used to sleep. The second sleep would be called the second sleep. Number one, is this normal? And number two, where did we get the idea of sleeping for 8 hours in a stretch? And I'll take my answer
offline.
Thanks,
Bernie. Thanks
very much.
Sure.
So this is a wonderful story about the discovery maybe 10 years ago. In the literature of, I think mostly from England, from the 15, 1600s, someone noticed that people are talking about, and then before my second sleep, we did this, or and then I had my first sleep. It was not as long as usual, but there was never a definition of it because it was so commonly understood that writers wouldn't mention it. It appears that the normal sleep pattern for healthy adults, especially as we get older, is a little bit biphasic. If you're 50 or more, you're probably used to the phenomenon of waking up somewhere between 3 and the 4 or 4 in the morning and feeling really wide awake. And the caller is very lucky because you'll notice he sleeps for 4 hours, then he's awake for 4 hours, and then he can sleep another 4 hours because he's got the time. The big problem in our culture with first and second sleep is we're going to bed late. We have a tie, so we go to bed at midnight, say, instead of at 11, planning to get up at 7. And so we sleep from midnight to 3:30, and we wake up. And if we stay up for 4 hours, that's when our alarm clock is going off, and we're in deep trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be that, normally we do sleep as a species, that we would sleep biphasically at night, being awake for some period of time. Where did the idea of that consolidated, that straight 8-hour sleep come from? I don't know. It's more a measure of what we see normally in people who don't complain about things like waking up in the middle of the night. So maybe those people who are sleeping 8 straight hours are more the exception than the rule.
Huh.
So, Bernie, you might be really normal.
Bernie, thanks very much for the call. Well, Dr. Stickold, thank you so much. It was just a really informative hour. Thank you. We will process this and sleep on what you've said. We'll sleep on it.
And I thank all of your callers and you, because it's been a wonderful set of questions and a great discussion.
Thank you. Our guest, Dr. Robert Stickgold. He's director of the Center for Sleep and Cognition at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. See, you're such a great audience. I love it when people say how good you are. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this program, and thanks to K.P., good man that he is, for answering phone calls as well. We'll be with you mañana.